We are in our study of how to study, and we've been focusing on figures of speech, figurative language, and we've looked at things like similes and metaphors, and tonight we're going to go into a little longer category as far as the texts themselves, and that's allegories. And allegories are used both in the Old and New Testament. We're going to look at some examples of those. Especially they're used when God wants to teach kind of an expanded lesson, but using the same illustration. And we'll see that as we look at some of these examples. And again, it's something that is used throughout the Bible. Sometimes they're simply called an extended metaphor, and I suppose that's as good a definition as any, but remember when we talked about metaphors, it was an example when Jesus was talking to Herod and called him a fox. He didn't say he was like a fox, which would be a simile, or he acted as a fox, but he was a fox for emphasis. Because there were certain characteristics of foxes that fit Herod. Well, that same type of thing is done with allegories, except it's just carried further. More characteristics are used. And typically it's not something that you would imagine being used as a comparison, which again makes it more striking and more memorable. So, let us go first to the Old Testament, to a couple of places, and we'll go to Psalms chapter 80 first.
Psalm what?
Psalm 80. This, if you read the whole psalm, it's about, of course, the nation of Israel. And about them coming back to God and being restored to God. Notice verse 3 of Psalm 80 before we actually get into the allegory. Psalm 80 verse 3 says, after he mentions some of the tribes like Ephraim, Benjamin, Manasseh, restore us, O God, cause your face to shine and we shall be saved. That's kind of the theme of the psalm, is about restoring Israel, restoring the nation. So what he does now is he uses an illustration, a comparison, to teach something about that restoration. And it begins in verse 8. Verse 8. You have brought a vine out of Egypt. You have cast out the nations and planted it. You prepared room for it and caused it to take root, deep root, and it filled the land. The hills were covered with its shadow and the mighty cedars with its boughs. She sent out her boughs to the sea and her branches to the river. Why have you broken down her hedges so that all who pass by the way pluck her fruit? The boar out of the woods uproots it and the wild beast of the field devours it. Return, we beseech you, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and see and visit this vine and the vineyard which your right hand has planted and the branch that you made strong for it for yourself. It is burned with fire. It's cut down. They perish at the rebuke of your countenance. I'm going to go ahead and stop there. First of all, the theme of it, again, is about Israel needing restoration, needing to come back to God so they can be saved. Now, he uses the nation of Israel and he compares it to a what? A vine, okay? Says, Israel, you're a vine. Well, if that was basically it, it would just be a metaphor, right? But he extends that and uses several different things that happens in the history of Israel and compares it to someone taking a vine and planting it. And so in this case, he's using that vine kind of historically to teach a lesson that they're going to remember. So, in verse 8, you brought a vine out of Egypt. Well, we know what came out of Egypt, and that was the nation of Israel. And basically, before God's people were in Egypt, they were really not a nation. They didn't become a nation until they left Israel. Left Egypt. And so he says, you brought a vine out of Egypt. There's the country being compared to a vine. You've cast out the nations and planted it. Now, what does that mean? What does that have to do with what happened to Israel? Into the promised land, absolutely. And planted them in the promised land. You prepared room for it. Again, he had done that and made a way, we might say, for them. Caused it to take deep root and it filled the land. And of course, that's what they did, especially when they got into the promised land, wasn't it? They started to fill the land. They were to take the weeds and get rid of them, the pagan nations and the pagan people, get rid of them, get rid of those weeds, so they could grow and expand like a vine would. And then he goes on and mentions how the vine spread. The hills were covered, the mighty cedars went all the way out to the sea, probably the Mediterranean Sea, the river, Euphrates River. So the Mediterranean Sea on the west, Euphrates River on the east. So he's describing how the vine, Israel, has spread all over that land, all over the country. And then he says, why have you broken down her hedges so that all who pass by the way pluck her fruit? Now what's he saying about the nation in the illustration? What has happened to it? Turned away from God, so God turned away from them, right? And they needed to be restored. And he talks about like the boar out of the woods uproots it. In other words, it pulls the vine up out of the land. The wild beast eats it. So, the vine is saying, return, we beseech you, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and see and visit the vine. Come back and restore us and bless us. And the vineyard which your right hand has planted, and the branch that you made strong for yourself. Desiring again God's blessings upon the vine. And so there's an extended metaphor. Yes, Israel is a vine. But he uses that and extends it into a much longer account. And so that's an allegory. A very good example of an allegory. There's another one in the Old Testament before we go to the New in Ecclesiastes. And you've heard this one, I know, many times, so I won't spend much time on it, but went right by it. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And the theme of the first eight verses, for the most part, it's found in verse 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 1. Would someone read that? I'm already getting tired of reading.
Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them.
Okay. The next eight verses talk about older age, being older. And in particular, of course, it's talking about older age of people who don't know God. In other words, people who live under the sun, as he talks about throughout Ecclesiastes, people who live without God, people who live ungodly, immoral lives, unrighteous lives, even though some of this certainly applies to all of us. Well, beginning in verse 3, he starts the allegory. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men bow down, when the grinders cease because they are few and those that look through the windows grow dim. Now here's the metaphor. He's basically saying old age or older people are a house. And then he starts talking about what happens in that house and the various types of people that would be in the house. The strong men bow down. Well, what happens to older people sometimes? Well, we start getting bowed down, right? The grinders cease because they're few. Probably talking about our teeth. I know I have to go to the dentist tomorrow. My grinders are not working like they used to, boy. They are in sorry shape. And those that look through the windows grow dim. Yes, they do. Right here's proof of that. They grow dim. The doors are shut in the streets and the sound of grinding is low when one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of music are brought low. Well, it has to do with our hearing. It has to do with our hearing and how we feel about hearing and how our hearing changes. And I remember my sister does this every once in a while, once every year or two, she'll bring up this little machine that tests your hearing, and it's all about how high a frequency you can hear. And every year, you know, you can't hear as high a frequency. It just goes down and down and down. That's typically what happens. And so typically you can't hear that broad a range. So music isn't as pleasurable as it once was. So again, he's using this idea of being older, but what it brings. But he's using it again in a way that you would remember it. And of course, they are remembering it. Also, they're afraid of height because we might fall. And of terrors in the way. We don't take risk when we're older like we did when we were younger in all kinds of ways. When the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper is a burden, and desire fails. Our desire of lots of things fail the older we get. For man goes to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well. Well, those are kind of depressing views of the final moment, but that's the way he mentions it, because he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, of course, for people who are godly, who are, and for us today, who are Christians and who are righteous, that's a wonderful thing. But for the majority of people who are not godly and who are not righteous and who don't know God, then that's a time to be dreaded. And that's a time to be feared. And so there's an extended metaphor. There's an allegory about growing older and what it brings, and putting it in some language that kind of emphasizes some of the things that happens.
It doesn't mean we have to like it.
No, he doesn't say that there, anything about liking it. That's not part of it at all. Nothing at all. And we can fight it if we like. He doesn't say there's anything there about fighting it either. But regardless of what we do, most of those things happen one way or another. Well, let's look at some of them in the New Testament, because this is used throughout the Bible. And they all have some great lessons, and we'll look at just whichever ones we can. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. This is a great one. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And like all of these allegories, and like all of these figures of speech and so forth, you've got to look at the context. Just like we talk about in parables. Usually it's the preceding verses that give you the context about what this allegory or figure of speech is going to be about. Well, that's certainly true in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Would someone read, let's see, I don't know where to really to start. Would someone read the first four verses? That'll get us started in 1 Corinthians 3. And that gives us kind of the context for most of the chapter. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, the first four verses, someone.
And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to the spiritual man, but as to men of flesh, as to infants in Christ. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you were not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you're not able, for you are still fleshly. For since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly, and are you not walking like mere men? For when one says, I am called, and I am of call, and another, I am of a callous, are you not mere men?
Okay, that gets us started on what's coming up as far as the allegory is concerned. Of course, we know the church at Corinth, from reading the whole letter, had various issues about a number of things. Here, the problem is that some of them were causing divisions because they were saying, instead of just saying they were Christians, well, they were Pauline Christians or Apollos' Christians or whatever. In other words, there was divisions because they were, when they were converted, some of them might have been converted by Paul, some were converted by Apollos, or some converted by someone else. So that's the context. That's what begins. Well, then he says, who then is Paul and who's Apollos, but ministers through whom you believed as the Lord gave to each one? I planted, of course Paul's the one writing that, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. This is what the allegory is getting ready to talk about. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. So we're talking about converts. Paul had, as he says, planted. He had planted the seed, hadn't he? Paul had planted the seed, Apollos had came along and nurtured. But who's the one that actually gave the increase? It was God. So no one has the right to say, you know, that I made you or I was really the one that converted you. You know, you and I don't convert people. It's God through His Word that converts people. And that's a entirely different lesson than what we're talking about. But that's a good lesson in itself. And that's what Paul is emphasizing here. One of the things is that it's not because of Paul, it's not because of Apollos, it's because of what God did through His Word that they were converted. And he says that every man will receive his reward. Well, Paul will receive his reward. Apollos will receive their reward according to their labor, according to what they had built. Their converts, the people that they had taught the gospel, that had received it. So, with that in mind, notice the allegory. It ends in verse 9 about your God's building. These Christians are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. What the building? Now he says the building are those Christians. So he says, let each one take heed how he builds on it. The Christians, the disciples that are made. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation, this is the building of the church. These are the disciples. These are the Christians. Gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw. Each one's work will become clear. Paul's work will become clear. Apollos' work will become clear. Peter's work would become clear. Mark's work would become clear. For the day will declare it. And of course we know it will. Judgment Day is going to declare what kind of work it was. Because it will be revealed by fire. Well, what happens to wood, hay, and straw with fire? It doesn't last, right? It's not lasting. But gold, silver, and precious stones are purified by fire. So the real lasting ones that Paul had taught, Apollos had taught, Peter had taught, John had taught, they're going to be seen because they're going to make it. So if anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, like the hay, wood, hay, straw, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Do you not know that you are the temple of God or the building of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? There's people that I've had a chance to teach, and I had a chance to baptize, and had a chance to water over the years, that they left the faith a long time ago, and unless they repent, they'll be the wood, hay, and straw. They're not going to make it. And I'm going to suffer loss because of that, because I know that they didn't make it. But at the same time, there's people I've had the chance to teach and baptize and water that are still faithful. And those are the gold, silver, and precious stones. And those are the wonderful ones that you want to know about. And so the ones that we have helped along the way, you know, the ones that don't make it, that don't endure, like he says, that don't endure to the day, you know, we're going to be sad about that. I'm sad about people I've known that I've taught or worked with that's left the faith, and there's a lot of them. And you do suffer loss at that. You suffer loss at it. And it's a very sad thing to see. But it happened to Paul and Apollos. Happened to Christ. Happened to Peter. So the people that we have taught, the people that we've influenced, if we have taught and influenced them properly, we're going to be saved. In other words, we're not going to be lost because they're lost. But we're going to suffer because we know they turned away from God, turned away from the faith. And that, of course, is a very sad thing. But it happened to Christ. We shouldn't think we're better than Christ. I mean, if it happened to him and he did everything absolutely perfectly, then, you know, certainly he was sad. He suffered a lot of loss because he saw people turn away. People that he had fed, like some of the 5,000 or some of the other miracles he had done. You know, John says that he stopped doing those miracles, and the people, some of them decided from that day that they weren't going to walk with him anymore. Well, you know that upset him. You know he was sad about that. But he had to let him go. So that would fit in, I mean, as far as the context, that would fit in here. So that's an extended metaphor. This is an allegory here where he's talking about that teaching and that process of people becoming part of the building of God, the temple of God, the house of God. And not all stay faithful. You know, here's another instance of some of the things David's been talking about on Sunday morning. Here's another instance where the Bible teaches that not everybody that becomes a disciple stays a disciple. I mean, that's exactly what that's talking about. Some of them do not endure. And they don't. And there's a lot of reasons why they choose not to, but they don't all endure. And so just because they're saved initially doesn't mean they're always saved. So it's another text that shows how that is not true. We have time for maybe one more. Let's go to Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4. And as David is telling us on Sunday morning, what does Galatians compare? What two things does it compare a lot in the book? The old and the new law. Well, this allegory does the same thing, compares the old and the new law. But it does so using a figure of speech. Beginning in verse 21. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it's written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise. Which things are symbolic. Now this one actually tells us that it's a figure of speech, that it's symbolic. For these are the two covenants. Alright, now he's making it even more straightforward. The one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage. Well, what covenant or law started at Sinai? Law of Moses, what we call the old law, the law of Moses. Which is Hagar. So he says, okay, now I'm making this again. Was the law of Moses actually Hagar the person? Well, no. But there are things about her life that help illustrate what the law of Moses was like. And so that's why he chooses her. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. You know, the book of Hebrews, as well as the book of Galatians, talks about how the law of Moses was in many ways a bondage. Calls it a yoke, right, in one place. Why do you want to return and put that yoke on you? So it did have to do with bondage. But now he says the other one, the Jerusalem above, see, now there's one Jerusalem that's below, the Jerusalem that's above is free, which is the mother of us all. For it's written, rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor. For the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. So we're not under the law of Moses. That's not the children we are. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. And notice the next verse. Nevertheless, what does the Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, we're not children of the law of Moses, but of the free. So we're children of the new covenant, the new promise. We're the children of the new Jerusalem, the Jerusalem above. And so there is a great allegory that is, again, an extended metaphor because it says, like, one of the covenants is Hagar. Well, that's a metaphor, but then he extends that metaphor and makes it into an allegory, again, describing the difference in those two covenants that he mentions in the first couple of verses. There are others. John chapter 10 is an allegory where Jesus says, I am the door. And then he says, I am the shepherd. Ephesians chapter 6 that talks about the armor of God. That's an allegory as well. So there's a lot of them, and we just talked about a few, but there's a lot to learn in allegories because they're pretty deep and there's a lot to gather from them, a lot of real good illustrations and descriptions. Well, thank you, and next week, Lord willing, we're going to look at two figures of speech that has really, because people haven't applied them, have caused a lot of strife and dissension in the religious world, and that's metonymy and synecdoche, and we'll look at those, Lord willing, next Wednesday.